Welcome to the Garden Talk Podcast, where we interview growers from all over the world, both beginners and experts, seeking to learn more about what they know about gardening and how they do things in their garden. What's up, everybody? For you that don't know me, my name is Chris, aka Mr. Grow It, and you're tuned into the Garden Talk Podcast, this episode number 117. In this episode, I interview Dr. Allison Justice. She has a PhD in plant environmental science from Clemson University. She is also a consultant, owns the Hemp Mine, and created the CRC, which is a science-based research group. She has advanced knowledge in post-harvest production, so drying, curing, and that's what today's episode is about. She talks about some of the key information when it comes to harvesting, drying, and curing, and she also talks about some studies that have been done in those areas. If you want to see highlights of these podcast episodes, search Garden Talk Clips on YouTube. That channel is dedicated to short, bite-sized clips of these episodes. I actually did a poll on my YouTube channel where this podcast episode is posted to, and 53% of the people that responded weren't aware that I have another YouTube channel. I call it my main YouTube channel, where I show off the plants that I grow. That channel has over 130 videos from the past 7 years, so if you're not familiar with it, I'll leave a link down in the YouTube description section below so you can easily get to it and subscribe. One of my goals for this podcast is to bring free information about gardening to the general public. That being said, I'd like to thank the sponsors of today's episode who helped make that goal possible. Thanks to AEC Infinity for sponsoring this episode. Check out their electric sprayers with a 2-liter capacity and an adjustable nozzle that can go from a strong jet to a fine mist spray. Their sprayers are battery powered and can be used for 3 hours on a full charge. No pumping required, and it's a one button operation. Click the link in the description section below so you can learn more about their sprayers, and the discount code MrGrowIt15 works on both Amazon and their website, acinfinity.com. Stash Blend. I've been using Stash Blend for over a year now, and it's awesome. One of the things that I really like is that it saves me money. It's a whole bunch of different inputs in one, so I no longer have to go out there and buy a silica bottle, then a separate seaweed bottle, beneficial bacteria, then a separate one for mycorrhizal fungi. All of that plus more is in this one blend. Go to stashblend.com to learn more about it, and I also have a link down in the YouTube description section below. Spider Farmer. Check out their 6-liter cool mist humidifier, which can be placed inside the grow tent or outside of it. If placed outside of your grow tent, you can use the included flexible hose, which splits into two, to help distribute the humidity evenly across the grow space. Also, check out their clip fan, which oscillates and has 7-speed settings to help simulate the natural wind outdoors. It has a 100-degree vertical manual oscillation and a 90-degree horizontal automatic oscillation. Discount code MrGrowIt5 works on both Amazon and the website, spider-farmer.com. And we are back. Welcome to the Garden Talk Podcast. Today, I am joined with Dr. Allison Justice. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it. We met last year at a conference, had a good conversation. You actually knew you before the conference, very familiar with your work. I went through the Utah State University, the cultivation certificate program, and I know you have a couple talks in there. Mm-hmm. And one of them was on post-harvest production, the harvesting, drying, and curing. And that's really what I want to get into today, is you just have so much experience in regards to that. And we've come so far in the past 5 years alone. It's amazing what we've uncovered. So yeah, I'm sure that you're going to give us a bunch of insight. And I think a lot of my audience is going to learn some things today that they haven't known, because I feel like a lot of the stuff still isn't widespread as much as it could be. But before we get deep into things, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into gardening?
Yeah. So, you know, I think I was born with it. I was born with green thumbs. My grandparents, my great-grandparents, their parents, everybody has been farmers for one thing or the other. So, I was basically born in a greenhouse. We grew trees, bare root, ball and burlap. We did petunias and pansies at one point, a little bit of everything. And so because of that, I swore I was never going to go into plants when I was older, but here I am with a PhD in plant science. I don't know. It's just one of those things when you're little, you're not going to do what your parents do, but you know, I loved it, and I got into it, obviously. But I got my PhD from Clemson University in plant and environmental science, and you know, to be honest, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do after graduation, and so I did some consulting for a while with pest management for greenhouses across the U.S. and started getting some calls for medicinal plant consulting. And so I took a few jobs and loved it. Packed my stuff up and I got a job first, but I packed my stuff up and moved to San Diego and stayed out there for about 3.5 years working for a vertical group, which was wonderful. I got to learn everything from seed to sell, as they say it. And then decided I wanted to do my own thing and, you know, have a little more freedom to research what I wanted and do what I wanted, and not be tied down by, you know, hitting a bottom line per se. So, even though that is of course still important, but you know, research and commercial production is certainly a different world to live in. So I moved back to South Carolina where, we've been growing under the hemp program. Since I guess 2018, and here I own the hemp mine, so that's a CBD company. You know, we do everything from breeding, selling genetics, all the way to harvest and consumer goods and that sort of thing. But really, what's near and dear to my heart is the research aspect, and we created the CRC, the Cannabis Research Coalition, with Dr. Faust at Clemson University. And so we've been running that for about 3 years now. And it's really a three-tiered program, I guess you could call it. One is more of a membership model where you give money, and what you receive back in return is early access to research, all of the nitty-gritty that may not be published in a peer-reviewed paper. SOPs, access to talk to, you know, hear and listen from some of the nation's top growers, you know, Glasshouse, State House, et cetera, et cetera. And so just a place to get together and talk about some of the problems you're having as far as growing goes. We're also a contract research organization. And so if somebody's having problems or if they have a great product and they say, you know, we've had as much internal R&D as possible, we need somebody else to verify it. Cause you know, you can trust your own research, but if you're someone trying to buy a product, you don't necessarily only want to listen to internal research. So we're that third party, non-biased, you know, nothing tied to support bias, which I know later you want to talk about that in a little greater detail, which I'm happy to. And then of course we do consulting and audits and things of that nature.
That's awesome. Yeah, you have so much going on. And Clemson University, Dr. Umsvos, big name there in regards to post-harvest production as well. I know he had a talk at Utah State University. You guys go real, real deep into it, and a lot deeper than I think the average home grower goes into it. Being able to expose some of the information here today, I think, is going to be really valuable. So let's just get right into it. Let's get into, let's start with harvesting, then we'll get into drying and then curing. So for harvesting, talking about the ideal time to harvest a plant. Now, it's mostly known that when the trichomes are mostly cloudy, that's when they're at the highest potency. Now, some people like for it to turn amber, where the inside cannabinoids go from THC to CBN. Is all of that still true today? Is that still the ideal time to harvest a plant?
You know, you said earlier that in the last 5 years, we've come a long way, but the deeper in I get, the more I understand how much I don't understand. So, you know, I'll give you what's known today, or at least what's theorized today, because, you know, there's more than what any of us in any of our lifetimes are going to figure out. You know, this is certainly going to be something that's done for hundreds of years, and is why this industry is so exciting for me, because if I were to study petunias or poinsettias, you know, there's hundreds of journals out there with great information already. So, but yeah, with harvesting, I would say the most important thing is to be delicate with the plants. You know, if you're in a commercial setting, a lot of times you're rushed in a hurry and you're just throwing plants around. You know, every time you touch a trichome, it will bust. For lack of better words. So just being as delicate as possible, having it touch as little things as possible, will certainly keep your plant in a lot better state. But as far as when, you know, what color the trichome is, you know, I have found by, you know, by being a breeder and seeing lots of different varieties, CBD, CBG, THC, you know, seeing all of the varieties that are out there that produce different cannabinoids, I've yet to find a true consistency of, you know, being able to say 10% amber, perfect harvest. It doesn't happen the same way with every variety. So, you know, what I always suggest is if you have a new variety, and a lot of this is costly, but this is perfect world scenario, okay? You have a new variety, and the breeder says it's an 8-week plant. At week, I mean, the earlier you go, the better, and you can graph it out and see how, you know, your THC, CBD, whatever it is, can progress and where it peaks and where it starts to decline, and you can compare that to, you know, what it looks like under the microscope, and then you have that to repeat from. But testing's expensive, and, you know, it's not necessarily worth it for everyone. But I would just say repetition and growing a variety. And a lot of it's personal preference as well. I mean, I like mine to be on the earlier side where they're more clear. And then there's some people that they want it to be extremely amber. So a lot of that's preference. And this is simply theory, but I do not think the amber comes from the THC to CBN conversion. I think it could be some sort of non-enzymatic browning, like other plants do when they ripen. So bananas and apples, when you cut them, there's some enzymatic browning happening. And so that's hopefully something I'll get to dig into this year, finding people to work with that can test some of these more nitty-gritty aspects of the plant has been pretty tough. And we finally got a university other than Clemson that will test for carbohydrates and the pieces that can lead you down that road of starch to sugar conversion. And, you know, what I truly think is the guts to what is equating to a good cure.
Got it. Yeah. So it comes down to personal preference. I personally like mostly cloudy with a little bit of amber. I talk to so many people who are just like, oh, 10% amber, 20% amber. But yeah, at the end of the day, it comes down to personal preference, like you had said.
You know, if you're looking at your trichomes and you're counting them, it can be tricky sometimes, because are you looking at the top ones where, you know, the light is directly hitting them? Or are you looking at a inside piece or a lower bud? Because all that can be different throughout the plant, too.
That makes sense. Now, you mentioned the starch to sugar conversion, which kind of relates to the next question I have here, which is in regards to flushing the plants before harvest. Now, there have been some studies that came out in regards to flushing the plants before harvest, whether or not it's beneficial. I've talked to many guests in the past. I like to bring this question up because each person kind of has their own little tidbits on it, little insight on it. And so I wanted to ask you this. Are there any benefits to flushing your plants before harvesting it?
You know, thus far, there's been a couple studies out about it. And, you know, I think the only true solid takeaway we can have is that if you stop fertilizing 2 weeks prior to harvest, there's no differences in what's been tested so far. And so that really is terpenes, cannabinoids, yield. I believe Mike's work, Mike from Clemson, his work was showing that if you go further than 2 weeks of fertilizer restriction, then you're going to start losing some yield, which makes sense. But right at that 2-week mark, you're not losing yield and you're not losing any sort of potency. So what that tells me is stop wasting your fertilizer, and, you know, you're not having any negative from doing it. So why do it? But again, theory, and again, something that this year we're going to get done is looking at what else is happening during that flushing process. You know, when you flush, you see color change, you see, depending on how hard and, you know, intense your flush is, you'll see faster ripening. And so it's my theory that is in fact what's happening, is you're cutting off the nutrients. A lot of times you're lowering the temperature, so the plant is being pushed into maturation faster than it would be if it were still getting all the nitrogen and everything that would be encouraging it to stay grow, I say vegetatively, but I don't mean it being in this vegetative form. I just mean in bulk. You're not pushing that nitrogen for excess growth. The plant thinks it's fall. They think, oh no, it's time to, you know, close up shop and protect these seeds. So we need to ripen. So I would expect, I suspect, that flushing does help to push maturation that then changes those carbohydrates from being starches to sugars. I also think there's some play in that as well, the starch to sugar conversion in those, I don't know, probably first 5 days or so of drying, because it is still active. You know, it's difficult to say when a plant is dead, because it depends on how, you know, it all depends on how much water is in it, ultimately. You know, is this thing alive or not due to the water in it, due to the water supporting some of the enzymatic activities that can happen. So I would expect, you know, those last few weeks of growing and then those first few weeks first couple of weeks of drying to really be when those changes are happening. And like I said, it's been a couple year mission trying to get the right testing available for this plant specifically to be able to check that.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Ever since that study came out by Arc Screen Technologies back in 2020, in regards, it really showed no difference between the two. I actually made a video on it and I talked about how, yeah, well, same viewpoint as you. It's like, well, you can save money on fertilizer. Why feed the plant up until the end if it's not doing anything differently for you? The responses I got off of that was hilarious. But now it seems like the biggest argument is the starch to sugar conversion. And right now we just don't have the data to back that up. And it's interesting that that's the route that you're trying to go to actively research and see if there is anything there. So looking forward to seeing what comes out of there in the future.
Yeah, it should be interesting.
Now, what about giving the plants a period of darkness before harvest? That's another thing that folks do in order to try to achieve a better result. Here are varying number of reasons of why people do it, but 24 hours of darkness before harvest, 48 hours of darkness before harvest, some people do even longer than that. Is there any benefit at all to giving your plants a period of darkness before harvest?
You know, again, it's been one of those things I've kind of sat on the fence about. Could see the benefit of why, and again, I would lend it towards being an act to encourage maturation. You know, we're digging deeper into trying to understand what the outer structure of the trichome gland, you know, how it's composed, what it's made out of, and what really encourages it to crack or not. And a lot of that works with cannatrol. But I think there's something to be found about its strength. And with proper curing and harvesting, not disturbing it, making it stronger and more encapsulated. You know, it's always been interesting when you go into drying rooms of large facilities, you know, you just smell it a mile down the road, and if it's the day of harvest, or, you know, a day after, whatever, and you can smell it. And, you know, my thoughts always, well, if it's in my nose, it's not in the plant. You know, there's terps in the air, and it's not like they're continuing to make these terpenes. And so, you know, at some point it's going to be spent. And so if we're able to preserve that trichome head better, you know, does that make your quality last longer? That's something that we're digging deep to, and it's hard. I mean, it's tiny. And so, you know, learning the scanning electron microscopy and really digging into that this past year and this year has been an eye opener, in understanding again how much we don't understand and being able to see in detail that close, because there are some drawbacks from it too. As cool as the pictures look, it's also not the whole story.
That's crazy. There's still so many people out there that prefer the darkness before harvest, and they're kind of blind in the fact on whether or not it is beneficial. So I guess that debate is gonna be ongoing from here.
I think so.
So any overall tips for harvesting, or anything we kind of need to know about harvesting before we move on to drying and curing?
You know, I think for harvesting, drying, it's delicate. You know, you've got to think of, even if it's 10 minutes where you've placed it in the sun, you know, if we're talking about for smokable flour, 10 minutes in the sun could do a ton of damage. So, you know, being fast at making your moves and, you know, being delicate and consistent with everything.
Okay. Now let's move on to drying. Talk to us about the goal of drying. Really, water activity is one of the things that come to mind right away. So can you talk to us about, you know, what water activity is and kind of the overall goal of it and so on and so forth?
Yeah, so, you know, drying is the first thing that comes to mind is, like you said, water activity for the point of not spoiling. So we're getting the water out just like we would any other foods, raisins, whatever it may be, getting it down low enough to where it does not support proliferation of microbes. Now, drying does not kill microbes. There's lots of spores and bacteria that are super hardy, and we can dry it down to a crisp, and those spores are still going to be there. So once it's rehydrated, they could take over. But the point is to get that water activity low enough to not support other life growing on it. And that's really the difference between water activity and moisture content. You know, they're very related, but the difference there is available water for microbes to persist in.
So the goal, correct me if I'm wrong, is 0.6 water activity, and that prohibits the growth of molds and yeasts and so on and so forth?
Yes. Yep. That is today's goal.
Okay. Now, are there any tools that growers can purchase in order to measure water activity?
Yeah, moisture content meters are pretty inexpensive, but they are also very damaging. To get a proper reading, you almost have to take a full bud and, you know, squeeze it as tight as you can and then stick the prongs in. But again, then you're ruining a bud, and that's not a great thing. The other thing, which is, you know, it's got its drawbacks too, is a water activity meter. And they can be quite pricey, $1,000 on up, you know, $10,000 for a really high-end one. So those aren't my preference either, at least in the home grower space. You know, it's overkill. One thing I like to do is put your plants in the drying room, bring it down to where you think it's just about right, and if you debud your flowers, put it in a jar, and then have a humidistat in the jar. Once you see the humidity level stabilize, that is your water activity. So your humidity then turns into the water activity. I mean, you got to move the decimal 2 points, but ultimately it's the same. So if you have a jar, put a few buds in there, and it reads 70% humidity after it's leveled, because there'll be a time of fluctuation for the moisture to homogenize throughout. But once you get to that homogenized state, if it reads 70%, let's say, then you're at a 0.7 water activity, and you might want to keep the lid open for a couple of days or that sort of thing.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's what a lot of home growers are doing today. So pretty straightforward there. It really, from what you're telling me, it's not really worth it to go and spend money on a moisture meter, a water activity meter for the average home grower. Just putting the buds in the jar and getting that humidity down, you're safe at that point. So for drying conditions, you know, temperature, humidity, what are the ideal dry conditions?
You know, I think the traditional 60-60 that everybody's been using for forever, it works. It works. 5 points either way also works. You know, I think being able to go slower on the days it takes to fully remove a certain amount of water is beneficial for terpene retention, because the faster you're bringing that water out, the faster you potentially could be volatilizing your terpenes off too. So I think there's a nice medium point which 60-60 it achieves well. You know, I think the time will come where we start to understand, again, how delicate these trichomes are. You know, one thing that you get when you're using very traditional systems, you know, let's say a mini split and a dehu, when you're looking at tracking over time, even though your set points might be 60-60, you've got these pieces of equipment fighting each other all the time. You've got the AC coming on, it's getting cooler, but then the humidity is also rising because the humidifier's off, or the dehu's off, and then it switches places because then it's, you know, then the dehu kicks on, but then that makes the room hot. So it's this constant cycle of on and off where you're also seeing these huge spikes up and down. And so I kind of like to think of it like a balloon. If you have a balloon filled with helium and you go outside and it's a humid day versus a not humid day, the balloon will float and it will expand and contract. And that's how I think of the trichome head, is expanding and contracting because of this environment. And at some point, the expanding and contracting will cause cracks. And, you know, these small cracks, how much terpenes, you know, how's the loss? And so that's what I'm really interested in, is taking a step further than just saying humidity and temperature and understanding the pressure that goes behind it. Because all of that is wrapped around VPD and really understanding the internal pressure of what's in that cell and the outside room pressure, and not causing those swings to be so intense.
So stability is kind of more important than the temperature and humidity in the grand scheme of things, because like I had mentioned, going and a lot of these folks that are drying in tents, they're having just that happen. For me, I have my humidifier kick on, fans are going around, sometimes I have exhaust fan come out, I'm exchanging the air, but there's a lot of swings happening, you know, and it might be 1 or 2 degrees, but those 1 to 2 degrees could be rupturing trichome heads, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So overall, what would be the ideal length of dry and number of days? I've heard anywhere from 7 to 14 days. I hear 5 to 10 days. We know the downsides of drying too quickly versus trying too long, and maybe you can get into that to begin, and then let us know what the ideal dry time day is.
Yeah, so I'd love to share with you, maybe you can squeeze into the talk. It's a graph we put out where it looks at days 1 to 14. It's looking at humidity and temperature and correlates the VPD. And it shows, you know, if you go out 14 days, it equates to this VPD and so on. And so it shows kind of right in the middle there at 7 days. If you are at that 60-60 mark, you should be able to achieve it within 7 days. It's a really useful tool. But, you know, obviously you can go further than, let's say you're at 60-60 and you go 8 days. Well, each day you go past, you're bringing more and more water out of that flower. And you may think, okay, well, I can just rehydrate it at some point. But we're starting to see a lot of extreme rehydration can cause a lot of browning as well. And so being able to pull it right at the right time and having to dry it a little more is okay. But if you're having to really, really have to rehydrate it, you won't have quite as great results. So the goal is to get it right where you want it, right when you pull it from whatever drying environment you're in.
Now, what about a 4-day dry? So I have the Canitrol. I know you're familiar with the Canitrol. I've got one right back there. Mm-hmm. And I love it. I've been using it for over a year now. Real consistent dries. Hands off as far as I'm not really messing around with the equipment now. You know, humidifier and fan and all that stuff. But I think in their normal settings, 68 degrees Fahrenheit and a 54 dew point, which I believe is 61% RH, I think it's a 4-day dry period. And then it transitions over to curing cycle. And that's the default settings. That's what they recommend. Is 4 days too quick of a dry?
You know, I don't think it's too quick. You know, again, we're working through all of these nitty gritty details, with Canitrol. I think anywhere between that 4 and 10 day mark is okay. And again, but until we can say, you truly need 5 days at a water activity of 0.8 to convert the starches to sugars, because that is what makes for the better smoke. It's hard to say there's much difference in 3 days, as long as you're not drying it out too much, which I know their product doesn't do. I also know their product doesn't have the extreme swings that the traditional equipment does. That's part of, you know, what their purpose is, to have extremely consistent pressure, you know, VPD. So no, I don't think it's too short, and you know, I don't think we'll be able to measure that until we kind of backtrack to what is a smooth smoke, all right, quantify that, and then backtrack from there to say, all right, well, 5 days would allow this process to fully develop to equate to the perfect smoke at the end. So, you know, sometimes I feel silly not having answers, but as a researcher, you're told, you know, you're told to be okay with not having answers, because that's your job, is to find the answers, not guess the answers.
That makes total sense. Now, on the other side, you had mentioned 4 to 10 days. And a lot of folks are drying for longer than that, 14 plus days. Now, I heard from Dr. James Faust, one of the talks that he had, he said the same thing. Same window, I'm pretty sure, was 4 to 10 days. And he talks about some of the dangers of drying longer than that. Can you get into that? What happens after 10 days when you're still drying?
Yeah. So there's certain danger if you're going out longer than 10 or 14 days. And the reason that is because any microbe that you had in your grow, you're taking it with you into the drying room. And the longer you have this bud sitting wet, the more potential you have for botrytis growth and proliferation all throughout the entire bud. For the most part, in traditional drying sense, when you're drying out a large bud, it's the outside of that bud that's drying first, and then the inside. And so that's why when I say put the buds in a jar and wait a day or so until it levels out, is because all of that moisture that's in the interior of the bud is then coming to the outside, and it's equalizing. And so if you're leaving the center of that bud at, you know, 0.88 water activity or even higher, you know, every minute is a second that botrytis or fusarium or whatever you might have could really take over and cause problems.
Got it. Yeah, that's one thing that I don't even risk. I usually go around 7 days, sometimes 10 days is the max. But if it's going on longer than that, I'm concerned. And I'm actually checking inside the buds and looking for visual. Although that could be there, it can be microscopic level. It's more than just the naked eye. You know, it could be there without us even seeing it. So scary. So you've done a lot of work with Cannatrol. I know you've done a study with them. That's actually on their website, cannatrols.com/research, if I remember correctly. Real brief, where I think a lot of people are looking for more details in regards to that. So can you break us down what that study entailed? I believe it was the Cannatrol versus the traditional 60-60 method. There was, I think, 16% higher terpene content in the Cannatrol drying. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so that was first stab at, you know, really trying to understand their unit and the flower it creates and that sort of thing. And so, you know, first stab as well, let's dry and cure at, you know, the two different methods, traditional and the Cannatrol system. And let's test what happens. And the problem they encountered and problems we've seen other companies encounter when testing terpenes is that if you don't have your own internal lab, there can be a lot of problems. And so, you know, you think about a dried flower, it's got 2%, 4%, whatever it may be, by dry weight of terpenes, which is, you know, that's a small number. If we're looking at 100%, 2% is very small. And so if we're mailing samples, even if you overnight it with ice, something's going to happen. And so any of effect that could happen during transit, or even if it's just being drove somewhere, anything within transit is going to affect the terpene levels. The other thing to think about is, you know, there's lots of great labs out there, but there's some that'll grab your samples and maybe treatment one sits on the counter for an hour, maybe treatment two doesn't. And so if we're looking at getting true results on just 2%, that can cause a lot of problems, a lot of skewed errors. And so the way we overcame that is that we work with a lab, Kacha, and I told them, you know, I want to do the extraction at my lab, and then I want to send you the liquid, because the solvent's not going to lose terpenes. It's going to be true to what exactly it was the second I pull it from whatever treatment is in. And so that's what we send to the lab. Those are tested. And so we can have very accurate results. And then, of course, have duplicates to make sure there's no off problems. So that's how we did the terpene testing. And that's the only thing that made me feel comfortable to do terpene testing, because it's so tricky. But yeah, so getting results back from 7 days traditionally drying and 7 days in the Cannatrol, that's the results we got. The other thing that you got to be super careful about and ask questions when you're looking at any study like this is, well, what was the water content? Because that can also skew the numbers. So, for example, if in the Cannatrol it's a perfect 0.61 water activity, and in traditional drying, let's say it went down to 0.58, you know, that might not seem like a lot, but in water weight, that will certainly skew the results. So we made sure we had all of those bases covered to where we're truly just looking at the terpenes that the plant produced compared to one to the other. And so that's the results we got, was 13% across the board terpenes. Each individual terpene, there was some, you know, skewed, but overall that certainly was the result.
Okay, now is there a white paper that folks can reference and read more deeply into it? Was it peer reviewed or anything?
We're going to duplicate it. And so we had reps within the study, but we want to duplicate it again before the final white paper. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to have a couple reps like that, just because you never know what could have went wrong along the way, and this is how you catch any problems that you may have.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one thing I mentioned in a handful of videos now, is that science is repeatable. You need to be able to take that and repeat it over and over and over again in order for it to be fact.
Exactly.
One study isn't just fact, right? One study could say anything. It could be wrong. There could have been something that went wrong with it, and then another study might come out and it's not repeated results.
Right.
So yeah, I think you're doing your due diligence, doing things right in regards to making sure that it can be replicated, and then going from there. So I'm looking forward to reading the final paper.
Yeah. No, it was great results. I was impressed.
I did make a video on this actually, and some viewers were concerned. They mentioned that was a conflict of interest a little bit, since Cannatrol paid for the research. So can you kind of explain how that works? So CRC, you mentioned that you are the owner of the CRC. You did the research for Cannatrol. Cannatrol pays money towards the CRC for the research to happen. I understand how some people can consider that a conflict of interest, but like in this industry, how difficult it is to get funding and the barriers you face in regards to this. Like, there's no government funding for you guys versus like other industries like food and beverage. There's so much more government funding and towards scientists and research and development, and all that stuff. Can you kind of break that? Oh, I know it's a little messy explanation there, but can you kind of break down how that all works?
Yeah. So funding is hard. It's extremely hard. You know, USDA likes to say that there are hemp grants out there, but they are not. They're mainly for fiber and seed production. And so if we're talking floral research, there is nothing there as far as the government goes. So our choices are donations from anyone, right? Anyone can donate. And that's our general donations is for our association. And so that's for research that is not coming requested by a company. It's just something that, you know, the growers might say, root aphids, we want X amount of our funding this year to go towards you looking at root aphid control, da 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 da. But then, as I was saying earlier, another tier is third-party validation. And so Cannatrol says, hey, I want to do this study. we want you to perform it and give us results. And I say, that is great. I will perform this study. But in respect to their company, I say, if you don't get the results you want, then I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. But if we get the results you want, I'll talk about the work we've done. So there's no paying me for certain results. There's just respect of use of results. I would just want to make it clear, when they pay for it, it's not like I'm going out and buying a new Volvo. It's Volvo. I don't know where that came from. New car. I don't know how to buy a Volvo, but, this pays for our research, the tests. Testing's extremely expensive. And it supports us in what we're doing. You know, even though it is a project for them, the way I see it, it's really a project for the industry to help to understand what's going on. I mean, if they were paying me to give results, I would have probably went a little higher than 13% or 18%. But so it's hard. And I understand people say, so and so is sponsoring this test, but all you can do is trust me when I say the results we give is what science gave us, and we're not falsifying anything. You know, just put it this way. I've been back in South Carolina 6 years now, and for the first 3 years, we've funded our own research. And I felt like I've not gotten anywhere because it's been slower than, if you had some huge government grant. But, the stuff we sell on our consumer goods side, that supports research, simply because I like doing it and I want to do it. And I know there's thousands of people out there that this will certainly help, not to mention the patients who take advantage of the plant science that's discovered, and how that trickles down all the way. But, the CRC has been great for us. It brings in a little extra money, and helps us get down to some of the problems we're having. So can I say it's not funded by someone? No, it's funded by someone, bunch of different growers, different companies, but I mean, all of our money, personally or not, has to come from somewhere. So all I can do is show the viewers and readers of research, throughout the over the years of the research we're giving, and just keep giving good results and helping farmers. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I appreciate you breaking that down. Yeah, I think there are a lot of people out there that are just kind of ignorant of that fact of how the research is funded and, where the money comes from. I was ignorant just a few months ago until I actually sat down and did the research and tried to figure out that, hey, the government isn't spending money towards this industry like they are in other industries. So it's a lot harder for scientists to be able to conduct research. And that's why it's so slow, as far as doing the research and getting information out there. It's just, there's no money here coming from the government that's really funding it like there are in other industries. So Appreciate you breaking that down for us.
Yeah. And there's no special research class that we can get in to, have certain deductions or help with testing costs. I mean, cannabinoids and terpenes, one test is $100 and carbohydrate tests is $400 per test. So it's limiting. So we appreciate everyone that can help us out.
So we can't end the drying section until we talk about freeze drying. And a lot more and more people are talking about freeze drying. What is freeze drying, and is it really the future?
I've played with it a lot. I have. In my opinion, I think for bubble hash, I think for any sort of concentrate extraction, that it's great and it's got a place. Now, I've seen some companies go out and buy millions of dollars of equipment and freeze dryers just for outdoor smokable flower. And I can tell you the ROI is not there. So just to give you an idea, I have a freeze dryer and it's just one of the, small 2x3 maybe harvest rights. And that is $3,500 with the pump and everything. And it'll hold a pound, and it takes 24 to 48 hours to run the 1 pound. So you can imagine, just a 2-liter you know, how long and how expensive that process is. So from a standpoint of ROI and making your money back, I can't see how that could be feasible. From a flower standpoint, it keeps it the greenest I've ever seen. But it's also very tricky to get the set points just right. I've done it and I've seen a lot of people do it where you put it through the process and it's, you know, it's just dust. But it keeps the plant exactly how it is when you harvest it. Let's just put it that way. So if we are finding that certain things like starch to sugar conversions, other certain aspects like that are important for that smoke, you're certainly not going to get it with a freeze dryer. Because again, it pauses it in time. You know, any set starch that's there will be there at the end of the freeze drying cycle.
Wow. So it could actually be a bad thing.
It could be.
Wow. Interesting. Well, it's priced too high for me, so I'm not going to be doing it anytime soon. I guess, yeah, for the average home grower, I mean, that price is crazy. Maybe in the future it'll come down. You know, there'll be competition, more people releasing freeze-drying machines. But as of right now, yeah, I think it's kind of priced a little bit too high and too lengthy of a process for the average home grower.
Agreed.
So moving on to curing. What is curing and what happens during it?
So in my eyes, curing is not just drying, curing, separated, you know, very discreet, separate times of treatment to the flower. It's really post-harvest handling. So it all kinds to go together with looking at the changes that are happening, the carbohydrate status. It's going from a very wet plant where changes are fast to a more dry plant where the changes are slowing down because the water's not there and available to let those enzymatic processes happen. And so in my mind, it's a one fell swoop in order to prepare the flower for use. So, you know, people will say, oh, it's for sweating, for just very generalized answers, like making the flower better. But, you know, again, here I am in my stance of that's my guess of carbohydrate change, but won't necessarily be able to answer that 100% confidence until next year. I say next year, 1/23, 25, we get on this talk again, and I'm hoping we have very different actually, I'm hoping we have the same answers, just with some data and details behind it.
Well, we know that burping, there is things that are happening, right? So burping, a lot of folks know about this basic method to where after it's dried, it's putting into a jar, turkey bag, or grove bags, and they're actually removing the lid of the jar, and off-gassing has happened. And I know there's been studies, I think it was Dr. James Faust who was talking about the studies done, the off-gassing, the CO2 levels, O2 levels, ethylene. Are you able to talk about any of that?
Yeah, so ethylene is, you know, I don't think it's looked at enough. And I understand why. It's very tricky to measure. But if you look at cuttings, so poinsettia cuttings that are shipped from Guatemala to the U.S. for our Christmas poinsettias, if you're thinking about those pieces of plant, fruits and vegetables, there's so much money and so many businesses that exist just to control ethylene, because it is, in short, a ripening agent. We have been able to measure ethylene, and so we know that ethylene, the amount that's produced is extreme in growing and drying, not as much as when the plant has dried out, so during curing, really. So we know the levels are extremely high, but we don't know if that is a good thing or if it is a bad thing, because maybe we do want the plant to ripen, which then is doing all of its conversions it needs to by having this push of ethylene, or is it beneficial actually to get down to a certain drying point and then stop the ethylene production, because you don't want it to go too far. But again, what are those metric points along the graph that we need to know here? Stop. And so Dr. Faust and I share an ethylene sensor, and it's finicky. It's finicky. You need a little bit of humidity. You don't zero it out properly. It throws crazy numbers. So I feel like it's been a boot camp just learning how to use it properly. So that is going to be a goal this year. We're doing a study with a company that makes post-harvest, let's just say, I can't announce who yet, but curing containers. And they're very excited about the thought of ethylene and what it could do or does. But again, it's just an exploration experiment. It's not, we're producing a product for them to implement. And so to be honest, this goes back to our previous conversation is, you know, a lot of the sponsorship money is simply going towards exploration because we don't know what the starting points are yet to alter that one way or the other. So, you know, experiment one is putting flour in different types of containers and doing measurements. And that gives you your baseline where after that you can say, all right, well, at day five, let's jack up the ethylene content and see what changes happened. So, yeah, ethylene, I believe, is a very important gas we need to take in account and start to figure out. And hopefully, again, this is the year to do it. But O2 and CO2 is also very important. You know, I would encourage you, if you have a sensor, and as a home grower, especially because if you're using a mini split, you're recirculating that air. And so even though you're recirculating that air and you're adding your CO2 because your plants are taking the CO2 away, what does that mean about your ethylene? Are you also just compounding your ethylene content since you're not actually bringing in fresh sourced air? I was talking with a grower probably within the past year, and he has a dry room that went out of commission, so he had to use an old growing room to dry in. Well, because it was a growing room, he had a CO2 sensor in there, and the numbers that the plants drying were producing, which he never would have looked at the CO2 content if it had not been him drying in the grow room, which measures it, and the numbers were like well past what's safe for a human to go in. And so, you know, again, I don't know what does that equate to exactly? I don't know, but when you have levels of anything out of whack, so extreme, you need to understand and be able to apply optimization behind it. And so it's wild being in an industry that we're still on many things, extraction, you know, especially on the patient side, patients understanding all the different cannabinoids, everything is exploration right now. So yeah, it's exciting, but it's frustrating having to repeat you don't know so many times. But none of us do, right?
Yeah, still a lot to learn, still a lot to uncover, and I agree with you. Very exciting. That's one of the reasons why I like to be in this industry. You know, I said in my videos many times in the past is doing the same thing over and over again. I mean, that gets boring to me. Being able to learn new things, uncover new things, try new ways to grow. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. It's fun for me. And so it makes the job more enjoyable. So yeah, looking forward to seeing what gets uncovered there in the future. So with so many different ways to cure or store jars, turkey bags, grove bags, what have you found to be the best method? And then are there any of those methods that you would say aren't good to do and you should avoid?
You know, it always comes back to there's a million ways to skin a cat. And a lot of my work is really working with the large scale growers who, you know, is looking at every penny spent. So for example's sake, even though stainless steel is great and it's easily cleanable and it doesn't break like glass and it does a good job, you know, would it be possible for a commercial grower to go out and buy all stainless steel containers for thousands of pounds? No, probably not. So, you know, a lot of my time and work is spent looking at those limitations of really commercializing on a large scale and making the best call based from that. Now, if I'm at home and I'm growing my own and I'm putting it in my own, you know, resource that's available there for me and there's no limitations, I probably would use glass. Yeah, I would use glass. So that's my short personal answer. But that's not always the answer for large production.
Got it. Yeah, I know. You hear through the grapevine of people being concerned about microplastics. You know, so the turkey bags, Grove bags, so on and so forth. But from what I'm understanding, there's no really research to back that up. That's just kind of a theory at this point. Yeah. So it'd be interesting to see if anything gets uncovered there. You know, that would be terrible if microplastics were leaking in there and we were consuming them. And
there's always something to worry about.
Yeah. Storage. I want to ask you one more question in regards to storage. So storage temperature, a lot of people store in, you know, 60 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly. Say the higher the temperature, the more terpenes are going to volatilize. You're going to lose it, right? But the lower the temperature goes down, I'm being told it's okay. A lot of people are storing in a wine fridge. That's about 50, 60 degrees Fahrenheit. That's one of my preferred ways to store. Some people in refrigerators, which is just above freezing, right? Typically, but 33 to maybe 44 degrees Fahrenheit. Any concerns in storing in a wine fridge or a refrigerator?
No, I think that's the best move. I would just be very certain that the container seals properly. You know, whatever container you're in is sealed. Because even in a refrigerator, even though it would be slower, it still can dry out if it's not made properly. So getting your drying down, your curing, and then holding at the exact water activity you want in the lower temperature. Yeah, I mean, the lower you can go, the better. But I know some people, they don't necessarily have a full wine fridge just for their curing, which would be pretty cool. Do you have that?
I do, yeah. I was using the wine fridge before the Canitrol.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, because you know, I live in Las Vegas, and it's very hot here. And natural room temperature, I'm lucky to get 70 degrees Fahrenheit room temperature. Normally it's 75, sometimes 80 degrees. And I used to just store it in those conditions. And within 3 months, browning happening, like those higher temperatures really degrade the product, you know? Yeah. So once I switched over to storing in the wine fridge, and yes, I have them in sealed jars. I also did in the Grove bags, made sure the humidity was locked in at 60 to 62%, but putting it in that lower temperature conserved them for a lot longer, you know, and I didn't have any browning. You know, I could have it for a year and there's no browning happening. So yeah, I was a big proponent of the wine fridge, not for drying. I want to be clear on that. Some people are trying drying in a wine fridge. Canitrol, now it's just for drying and curing. I think one of the biggest benefits of the Canitrol is the drying. A lot of people think, oh, well, I'll just buy a wine fridge. It's like, well, go ahead and try to dry in a wine fridge. It's, you know, you're not going to get a good result unless you do some sort of alteration to it. Anyways, yeah, I am a proponent of the wine fridge for storage in particular. And just wanted to kind of pick your brain a little bit on storing at 60 degrees versus in a refrigerator at 40 degrees, if there's any big difference between those two.
I think, like you said, it's just the length of shelf stability. The colder you keep it, the slower any of those degradation processes are, and the longer it lasts. So yeah, I think it all just matters of how picky you are with perfection and wanting to keep it as green and really longevity. If you know you're going to smoke it all in in a month, then maybe it's not necessarily required to have your own fridge for that, and it'll do just fine in a you know, a temperature controlled room. But yeah, the cooler, I would say the longer is really the takeaway.
Good to know. A couple more questions for you. One of them in regards to any studies that have been done recently in the past year or two that have revealed some valuable information that you feel like would be valuable to the audience.
You know, there's a couple studies out of UGA that have, I don't know if they've been published yet, but it was a post-harvest study, and she was looking at terpenes and hemp at different curings, but you know, again, going back to this, it's all exploration. Hers was very dirty with, you know, the barn hanging. The 60-60 method was the best representation. And then she was looking at some of the techniques you would do with tobacco. So, you know, fire curing and those sorts of things. So, you know, there's been some studies and some nice generalizations we were able to conclude from them. But, you know, if you're looking for extremely high quality smokable flower, at least I haven't seen it in the past couple of years. Because, again, a lot of it has been on hemp, with really the thought being outdoor hemp that you're drying fast for isolate production. One exciting thing we've begun and about to start phase one on, which we could certainly use your help on getting the word out on this. So are you familiar with Miyabi Shields and Riley?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So they're both PhDs in basically plant chemistry. They both have a little bit different specialty in each. And so they now run the nonprofit NAP, the Network of Applied Pharmacognosy. And so we've been friends for a while and been trying to find a way to work together. And so we've now figured it out. We want to do a large project that's called the Science of Smokeability. Because basically everything from flushing to the joint being in your hands is what we're looking at. And really trying to put understanding around what means or what represents a smooth smoke. What is it about the color of ash that matters? There's been people say that certain smokes can make their tongue tingly and go numb, which I've never experienced that. So that one's going to be a little harder to dig into. But some of these generalities that everybody expects, you know, I want my ash white, I want it to be smooth, I want it cured for 5 months. You know, we really want to look at, again, the end point, so consumer preference, and back it up to be able to say what's doing what. And so that's a lot to cover. And so we're breaking it into phases. With phase one, it's going to be pretty easy, pretty straightforward. You have flour, it's all ground to the same micron size, it's all packed to the same density, and it is all the same water content. Excuse me, it's not the same water content. You've got different water contents, because we said, all right, well, that'll be the easiest, is simply looking at water content. And so some with a 0.4, 0.6, and 0.8. So you've got a high, you've got a low, and you've got what everybody says is just right. All right, very easy to get joints at three different contents like that. Send those out to the public, people that's interested in the study, and have it double blinded. And then the people say, all right, well, this smells the best, this tastes the best, this smokes the best. You know, we'll get super nitty gritty into the patient discovery, which thankfully they've got experience on, because I'm usually just with the plant. But they're really good at connecting the plant and the treatments with the person, and how to gather data from a person. You know, that's not something I have specialty in. So that's where we kind of all come together as a nice group, ranging from, you know, growing all the way to smoking. So phase one, water content. We're going to have CBD joints, and we'll be mailing them out and getting test results back and see what's going on. I mean, the past 2 years, I've dug so hard into tobacco research. It's been ridiculous. But, you know, if you think about cigarettes, if you're a smoker and you go to one state versus the other, or if it's 2 years difference, you're going to expect that cigarette to be exactly the same. And you're going to be mad if it's not. And so there's science and there's repetition and there's a lot that's going in to get that cigarette exact. And that's what we can do in cannabis. You know, we know when good ones are good, and there's growers that can produce good ones consistently, but how do you convert that to be able to show other growers this is what's good. Until you have data behind that, you can't. So that is our goal, is first start with water content, and then we'll go on to other things like certain elements that can accumulate that causes a bad smoke. There's certain elements that can accumulate that that will cause the ash to break off faster than others. So phase two will be elements, because in tobacco, they go deep into, you know, even the government restricting certain applications of certain fertilizers in excess because it will mess with the smoking process.
Super interesting. I follow both of them on social media, and they're always coming out with interesting information. Speaking of social media, let's wrap things up. Can you tell the listeners how they can find you and what you have upcoming in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. So Instagram, of course, we've got dr.justice underscore grows, and that's my Instagram. And then, of course, the CRC is just Cannabis Research Alliance. Look us up there. We've got websites, easily Googleable. I won't spell out all the long names. The Hemp Mine is our CBD brand. And yeah, follow us on basically all social media platforms.
Awesome. And I'll definitely have a link to her Instagram down in the YouTube description section below, so you can easily navigate to that and find her. If I missed any questions that you think that relate to harvesting, drying, or curing, drop them down in the comment section below. Love reading through the questions. And maybe if there's enough questions, we can get her back on and see if we can get some of these questions answered. So Dr. Allison, thank you so much for coming on today. I appreciate it. This has been great talk. And I think my audience is going to get a lot of value from it. So thank you for your time today. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Talk to you soon.
Peace out, everyone. Catch you in the next episode.